It's Tuesday, the 11th, August 1998. In the Creekside room this morning, we have Chuck Schaefer. Today's session number is 98.6, and it's titled Afro-Realism, A New Generation of African Leaders. Let's listen in.
They have about 6 to 8 feet of barbed wire, that razor sharp barbed wire that's all rolled up. And there's surveillance cameras on all the walls. And I got to know one of the security people in another activity. And he says, not only that, but there's security, you know, down the road about 300 yards. There's all sorts of surveillance and security. So the whole perimeter around the American embassy is well surveyed with spy cameras and, you know, people looking out. And I imagine that intense security was less in these countries, and that's why, you know, it went up. But, I mean, just from the very little that I've heard about it, it almost sounds like it was an outside job, probably some kind of Islamic fundamentalist group coming in from maybe Iran or Iraq or something like that. But since that's not the gist of what we're going to talk about today, let me sort of approach this topic. What I want to talk about today is Afro-realism. This is sort of I was introduced to three new vocabulary words last year when the Undersecretary for Africa, who is a Ghanaian, came to a conference that we had in Indiana at IU. This was supported by the Indiana Consortium for International Studies. And he sort of introduced three new words that I quickly jotted down and I'm using today. One is Afro-optimism. The second is Afro-pessimism. And the third is Afro-realism, which sort of, I think, conceptualizes where leadership and the ideas about Africa have sort of gone. And so I'd sort of like to talk about that. But since we're talking about leaders, and just as a primer, let's go collectively around this room and try to figure out how many African presidents or prime ministers we can name. Okay? this is a real humiliating experience, isn't it? Okay, let's see. Who can we name?
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi, yes, very good. Gaddafi, Libya.
Nasser?
Nasser, he died a long time ago.
Current.
Current, yes. Yeah.
South Africa,
yeah. Mandela, very good. We got Gaddafi, America's enemy, and Mandela, America's friend. Two of them. How many more can we name?
That's it.
Netanyahu.
You're kind of on the edge. But.
Yeah.
The big guy just died. I can't remember his name.
Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, who fortunately was the one of the worst tyrants around. Yeah, so, well, evidently you don't know that many African leaders, so I can BS all I want.
No.
I'm joking. But I think that sort of gives me an idea of what you may know. When you think about African leaders or African politics, what do you think of? What are some of the descriptors that you would use to talk about African politics?
Destabilize,
right.
Dictator.
Good. Yeah, very good. Destabilize, huh?
Tribalism.
Volatile. There's one word.
New. I think they're all new.
They seem to sort of come. They seem to sort of go. They all seem to be in a perpetual.
And no boundaries.
Nope.
Boundaries.
Military dictator.
Military dictator is oppressive. Yeah. So I think
manipulated by the other nations.
Okay. Yeah.
Oligarchy.
Yeah. Oligarchy, you know, a little bit of friends. So, I mean, all of those words that we just sort of talked about are pretty negative. We're supposed to watch our language around here, so I was going to use a a four-letter word with a D, starting with a D, but I won't. Yeah, I think they're quite negative, and certainly there's justification for that. Now I'm going to put an overhead here, and I don't want you to be sort of bowled over by the amount of stuff that I have on that outline. I just enjoy an outline because it sort of keeps me honest, and it keeps me sort of thing. It sort of keeps me from straying into stories and into asides, which I tend to like to do. But essentially what we have here is, let's see if that's focus, Afro-realism. And this is from President Museveni, who is one of these new generation of leaders of the country of Uganda. And I think this his idea, oh, thank you very much. His idea of his quote there, good cows need good politics, is probably very accurate. And so I think there's a connection. He certainly sees a connection. He has this large herd of cows. He oftentimes, instead of staying, you know, counting his Mercedes like other dictators have done, he goes to his private ranch, I guess, and looks at his cows. He knows them all by name, and he really sees the connection between what is going on at the grassroots levels amongst the agriculturalists and the pastoralists, and what should be going on at the very top. And so he comes up with that. But let me go back before and essentially talk about Afro-optimism. And this is sort of the euphoria of independence and Pan-Africanism. You have to remember that in 1956, Ghana was about the first country to get independence. And then there was about a four-year hiatus when all these rebels were running around leading these revolutions. And the European powers still had strict control. Then 1960 comes, the French just give away all of their colonies to the various leaders of them, and the Belgians follow, and the British sort of see that they are behind the times. So by 1964, most of Africa is independent. So independence really was a rapid transition, and oftentimes many of the countries were unprepared for it. Well, what did this sort of mean? The new sort of rebel leadership oftentimes assumed authority, and they really thought that they could, that all it really took for Africa to develop, to become principal participants in the world economy, was to reinvest. There was this old notion that colonialism sapped all the resources out of Africa, took them to Europe or wherever, and built up the industrial economies of Europe, and then the manufactured goods were re-exported back to, say, Ghana or Nigeria, and sold at very high costs. And so what the idea was let's just cut that. Let's keep the profits in our country. And let's sort of do import substitution, which was one of the big words at that time. So there was this incredible optimism. There was also incredible optimism in terms of the agricultural output. I was a missionary kid in Ethiopia. And, you know, this was in the 60s and up into the early 70s. And, you know, I was a kid, so I really wasn't analytical. But I remember the optimism my father had. He believed that Ethiopia could become a breadbasket, not only the Horn of Africa, but a lot of the Middle East. You know, that a few things just had to change, and then all of a sudden, this manpower, or woman power, would just be there, and they would, you know, with a few modern introductions like fertilizers and pesticides, they would grow a heck of a lot of grain and be able to export to the Middle East. And I think that sort of euphoria not only pervaded the Africans, but all sort of the development experts that were coming in. They thought, yes, Africa, you know, there was a real sense of optimism in the 60s for it. And I think one of the things that they were thinking about was trying to look at Africa as an economy itself. And this goes with this idea of Pan-Africanism and connecting up the railroads. So let me just sort of quickly draw a map of Africa and sort of use railroads to illustrate what we're talking about here. There we have Africa. And if you look at Lagos, Nigeria over here, and Ghana over here, Angola here, Mozambique, East Africa, just as in Southern Africa, almost all of the railroads built by the colonial powers went into the interior, sort of like that, to wherever it was that they were exporting. Say from Mozambique, they went into Zambia over here and exported copper. From East Africa, they would sort of go into the interior to export sisal and coffee and tea. And so you have this ribbon of railroads that just goes into the interior, but all of them feed into the port cities. And so, you know, they were saying, what is this? There's not one railroad in all of Africa that connects two countries. They're just going into the interior and they're sapping our resources. And so the ideology was behind Pan-Africanism was let's connect up. Let's not always go to Europe and do all of these things. Let's connect up, and that way we can do anything we want. And there was an enormous amount of optimism. I think the apogee of this optimism is sort of written down in the charter of the OAU, that is the Organization for African Unity. And what does this say? Well, there's a few things. Respect for the territorial integrity of frontiers. So somebody was saying no borders, but at least within this charter, these new nations are saying, well, let's respect the old colonial borders, which is a real problem, because sometimes those colonial borders go right through a sort of an ethnic or tribal group. Do any of you sort of remember Biafra? Mm-hmm. Way back, I remember in our family devotions, we would always sort of pick up some of the hot spots of the world. After a while, my dad would come to the political part of the family prayer, and it would always be, you know, praying for this disaster or that disaster. And one of the first I remember was Biafra, which is sort of on the edge of Nigeria over here. And the border goes right through it. And so half are in one country, half are in another country. But the charter of OAU says that you have to respect it. Well, that's not very good. Also, the second portion is the non-interference in the internal affairs of member states. So, if there's a dictator and you're right next to a dictator, you acknowledge the existence of that dictator and doing whatever he wants to do in the internal affairs of his country, but you don't interfere. So, there's a number of implicit conceptions within the Charter of OAU that actually sort of bode against what the euphoria of this time sort of hoped for. And I think this is best spelled out in the realities of neo-imperialism. There is a thesis that the reason France and Great Britain got out of Africa was because to maintain a colony of Nigeria cost the British more than they were actually getting out of it. And so therefore, it was uneconomic to keep all of these colonial administrators over there and pay them fairly good salaries and all that, when the sisal and some of the palm oil that you were getting from Nigeria did not quite pay up for whatever you were doing there. So, in fact, when the Europeans extracted their colonial administrators and no longer had sort of the political obligations and the economic costs of maintaining these colonies and the schools and all of that kind of stuff, they were actually doing a lot better business because, you know, they were the markets for the coffee, the tea, the whatever, but they didn't have any of the obligations, so they could just come into, say, East Africa over here and give them the world market price for coffee and tea without giving, without paying out. You see what I'm sort of saying?
Well, they also kept financial control and all the loans.
Yeah, the loans, there's a whole multiple aspects to it.
But colonialism without the responsibility.
Exactly. It's in colonialism and imperialism without any of the responsibilities or the payments that are assumed in it. And so for the West, and the United States got into neo-imperialism in a big way. We're still doing it in many places. But for us, this was just simply a business transaction that was a hell of a lot better. And what the Africans found is that they really could get out of the web of this world economy. That the mark that they could never really decide that they're with their growing cotton. They're going to manufacture it into clothes and sell it to the rest of Africa. Why? Because the quality of their clothes was pretty poor, and every other market in Africa was trying to do the same thing. So the Nigerians were trying to sell textiles to Ghana. Ghana was trying to do the same thing to Nigeria. Where was the market? The market was out there. So you serve your own little country, but then when you go across the borders to other countries in Africa, they say, no, we have to protect our own. The only market that is able to assume it is the world economy, which gives you these low prices. So the realities of neo-imperialism just put a depressing sort of ambience on the whole thing. And so what do we get to? We get to Afro-pessimism. And here, I suppose this sort of begins to emerge at the end of the 60s. Certainly by the 70s it is there. The 80s are the nadir of Afro-pessimism. You have so many dictatorships, you've had so many coups, you've had so many, you know, all those words that you use to describe African politics are there. And what do you get? You, essentially, what was the state? You know, what is the state? What is the purpose of the state? The state is supposed to serve the people. Well, how do you do it? In Africa, and I think in many other places, certainly the First Ward of Chicago and Chicago politics, which I'm somewhat familiar with, but you probably have it in your own locale. You know, what is politics? It's a fabrication of all sorts of relationships. And usually the politician is the patron, and you, the electorate, are the clients, and you know, you say, well, I'll vote for you, but this is what my neighborhood needs. We need a better garbage pickup. We need better water, or service utilities, or whatever. Well, in Africa, it's sort of the same way. But patron-clientage is a little bit different in the sense that, what can I give you? I can't really give you better utilities. That costs me too much. I can't really give you garbage pickup because we don't have any trucks. And so what can I give you? I can give you a position in government. And so you get this, you know, this huge, huge bureaucracy that emerges in many of these states in the late 60s and 70s that far outstrip the utility of the state. But that's the only purpose of state, to give jobs. And where does this lead? It sort of moves into patrimonial rule. That is, the person at the very top who's dispensing all of this largesse, all of these goods to the people, assumes sort of the character of a father, you know, sort of a patriarch of the Old Testament almost. And so if you look at that first generation of African leaders, of Nasser, of Jomo Kenyatta, of Julius Nyerere, of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, all of them, after about 3 or 4 years, began to sort of conceive of themselves not as dictators, but more as fathers looking after their extended family. And the family then became the state. Well, you know, when they were elected, when this group of people were elected, they were all elected as presidents. But when they began to sort of feel that they were fathers, a father never really necessarily wants to give up protecting his children, right? And I don't think this first generation ever wanted to give up the protection that they had over their children. So what did they have? What did they then do? Well, they began to invent a new sort of title for themselves: president for life. You know, I was elected president back in 64 or something like that. Now it's 74, and I'm sort of feeling sort of good about this whole thing, and I don't really like elections, I don't like politics, I just sort of like dispensing goods and, you know, being in that political makeup, and so therefore I will anoint myself as president for life. Do any of you remember Idi Amin?
Yeah.
Okay. He was, you know, sort of the epitome of this guy, of these characters. But maybe he wasn't the most ridiculous. I mean, what did he want to do? Oh, I remember, I think it was during Nixon's time, and he sort of was a little bit angry at the United States for something or other. And so he thought the best way to settle this disagreement with the United States was for Nixon to come over and put on boxing gloves, and for him and Nixon to duke it out, and then they would settle out this disagreement or whatever. You know, well, what's the chance of that? You know, Nixon's about maybe 5'10" or so, and Idi Amin I think was about 6'5" and maybe close to 300 pounds. There's no way, but. One of the worst guys was this guy called Emperor. It's in Central African Republic, and he had renamed it Central African Empire. It'll come to me. But anyways, he was this old military guy. He was a sergeant. He had this coup d'etat, he became president for life. He didn't really like that title, so then he wanted to become emperor. So he renamed his country Emperor, and the Central African Empire. He looked around, he was appraised that, you know, Napoleon had this huge sort of coronation. So he had a crown just like Napoleon's crown, made for himself. He had the same sort of garb as Napoleon. He imported something like, I think, 60 Mercedes 600s. Do you remember those old, big old boats that they used to have? I mean, they're gorgeous machines. But he imported, I think, 60 of them for his regalia. He threw this huge, huge party for himself. Central African Republic is located right here in the middle of the Sahara. There's no resources at all. This party essentially has bankrupted Central African Empire or a republic to this day. There's nothing. But I mean, this is sort of the kind of leadership that was emerging. Well, where do we get to? We get from this kind of leadership, we get a lot of military dictatorships. They were looking at the stupidity of this first generation of people who had become these presidents for life. And since they had the tanks, the guns, it was easy for them to take over power. And you have throughout Africa example after example of military dictatorship. And what were the only solutions? Once a country was into a military dictatorship, there were two. One was for another young guy to emerge and
and form another military coup and oust the first one, which happened quite frequently, or for a military dictator to decide that it was time to return politics to civilian rule. And this has happened, maybe a dozen times. I don't know, maybe I'm exaggerating. Almost a dozen times in Nigeria here. You get a military dictator, he thinks, well, you know, this isn't going so well. Maybe it would be better for the country and the politics and of the whole region to instill a civilian rule. So he'll call on an election. The elections are all sort of rigged. But someone emerges who supposedly has the popular vote, is president, is pretty much a puppet for himself, and is there for a while until the dictator doesn't really like him, and then he ousts him and goes back into military rule for a while, and then another election. This is sort of time and time again. Well, I think in terms of what was happening to Africa, this was the worst time. The late 70s and the early 80s were a terrible time. I was a relief worker in Ethiopia during the famine of 84 and 85. You remember around Christmas time of 84, the whole American media was barraged with all those starving Ethiopians, and there was many, many hunger appeals, and I'm sure you all gave to it. During that time, in about February, I went over to Ethiopia and volunteered there. We had a military dictator. He had nationalized everything. Supposedly everything was honky-dory. And in reality, people were just going downhill. The possibility of Ethiopia regaining some sort of per capita income was just not there. Plus, he had to contend with a burgeoning population, and the economic crisis was just pervasive throughout most of Africa. Certainly in Ethiopia here, we had the famine, but there were famines throughout all of the Sahara. So there was a band of famines almost the whole Sahelian Sahara region of Africa. There were famines emerging down in here. And I mean, the basics, the least you expect of a government is that it should feed its people, right? And it couldn't even do that. For the free press and for the intelligentsia, they were just sort of despondent.
You say they couldn't feed their people. Are you really meaning they wouldn't because they had other priorities like their military and retaining their own power and accumulating their own wealth?
Yes, very, very perceptive. In some areas, I don't believe they could. Certainly in Central African Republic, in Niger, in parts of Ethiopia, they could. But Ethiopia, during that famine, was putting almost, what was it, something like 42% of GNP, gross national product, into its military to fight a war in the north here with the Eritreans. So, if they hadn't done that, maybe they could have fed themselves. But you're absolutely right. And in other places in which people where there was famine, the dictators were taking the foreign aid and putting it into their own pockets. This was certainly the case in Somalia over here, where Bulcha was just stuffing his pockets and buying chateaus in France and living a pretty darn good life.
Did you groundworkers have over resources that were coming in then?
In Ethiopia, the amount of graft, the amount of the grain that never reached the people, we estimate, or the best of the experts estimate, was around 10%. In Somalia, the amount that reached the people was maybe, the amount that didn't reach the people was around, in other words, in Ethiopia, about 10% didn't reach the people. In Somalia, around 60-65% didn't reach the people. It was all going into, you know, corrupt officials' hands. And it varied. But I've also did a study in the late 80s when I came back to try to compare that with the port of Chicago, and they estimate that corruption in the port of Chicago is around 11%. So, you know, one has to be a little bit, one has to also look at what's going on in one's own backyard before one looks in with derision at what's going on in Africa. Somalia, of course, and many other parts of Africa was a whole other story. So that was sort of what was going on. And I think the intelligentsia in Africa was just absolutely despondent. I remember conversations with Ethiopian academics, with Ethiopian government officials, with OAU officials from Kenya, and one from, I think it was I think it was Ivory Coast, who in confidence said that perhaps the best thing that could happen to Africa was to be recolonized. I mean, this, I think, sort of shows you sort of the depth of despair. They were looking almost longingly at a colonial period when at least they could have a free press and they could rail against those British or those Frenchmen or whatever. But now, you know, any journalist was, you know, came out with a critical article against the government was put in prison or worse, killed, tortured and killed. And so it was a time of enormous despair. Well, we're finally sort of getting to Afro-realism. What happens here? I think the major sort of cause for a new period in Africa, and this isn't all new, because as some of you heard, at least you were there yesterday, when I talked about the genocide in Africa, you know, instances of genocide and human rights abuses still exist chronically in many parts of Africa. But in the midst of that, there seems to be a new generation of leaders emerging who are far more realistic about what they can expect and what they can do, and they seem to be less corrupt. So you have the collapse of the Soviet Union, and what did this do? This essentially stopped the Cold War in Africa. Tomorrow, let's put a plug in for to see if I can incite some of you to come to my talk tomorrow. It's not going to be a talk, it's going to be a slideshow. And the question I'm asking, was the Cold War ever hot in Africa? And I do have some slides, and I think the question we're going to be looking at is what were we and the Soviet Union doing in Africa from, say, the 60s, he was talking about 1,000 points of light, bright new era. I forget what his pen phrase was. Well, anyways, he seemed to be talking about this, the reinvention of the world in the post sort of Soviet Union, and American foreign policy. Trying to implement this, especially on the third world, especially in Africa. And we almost forced elections on many of the countries. In the period 1990 through 1992, or even after 1992, in Africa there were 48 national elections that were called sort of arbitrarily. Because of the influence and the insistence of the United States and the West,
on Africans to promote democracy. The key words were free market and democracy. And so all of these African leaders, knowing that they didn't live in a bipolar world anymore, but in sort of one world where the United States was the dominant power, the dominant hegemony, had to reinvent how they conceived of themselves and even learn a new vocabulary. So what you had in much of Africa was, for example, in Ethiopia and Eritrea, were these rebels who had been out in the bush for 15 years, who had gone through college, through high school and college in the 60s and early 70s, who could probably quote the Communist Manifesto word for word, and who knew Marxism and Leninism and Stalinism and Trotskyism and Maoism real well, who could argue the subtle points of all of these sort of neo-Marxian isms. In fact, the ruler of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, was elected as quite a young man to head his rebel group simply because of his argumentative skills. He knew Marxism better than anybody else. He gets into power, Soviet Union collapses, he goes, oh no, what do I do now? He's a really intelligent guy. He relearns a whole new vocabulary. It's like he went to the University of Chicago and took courses with Milton Friedman, you know, the author of sort of the capitalism, sort of supply-side capitalism. And you know, he's learned this rhetoric so well. And he and other people have to implement elections, and they do. And they supposedly open their markets to foreign companies. And the results are exceedingly mixed. I went out as an election observer, sponsored by the United Nations under the auspices of America, Trans-America organization out of Washington, D.C. in 1992 and then also in 1994 to Ethiopia. And I saw elections at the grassroots. What does that really mean? It means the leaders speak the rhetoric to the ambassador, the American ambassador, but when it comes to electioneering at the local level, they forget to send the ballots. Therefore, it's null and void. Or they forget to send the ballot boxes. Or sometimes they forget to send the locks on the ballot boxes. Therefore, even though everything ran quite well, especially in areas where the opposition was assured of winning, they would have to throw out that big, you know, barrel of election ballots simply because there was not a lock on it, and it could have been tainted. So you know, they used all sorts of ruses to make the election results in areas where they were not dominant null and void. But they also learned one other thing. They also learned that the West doesn't like Soviet-style election results. You remember in the Soviet Union, in years past, Stalin and Khrushchev and all those other leaders would win by 98.9% or something. Well, whatever it was, they thought, you know, leading by around maybe 55 to 62% was a very, very good result. And in American politics, that's a landslide, you know? But they all had landslides. Yeah, right. So in reality, what was happening was same old, you know? Just with new rhetoric. However, I think emerging emerging in this is a new group of leaders, sort of a second generation of rebel leaders who have sort of either assumed some of the rhetoric, but have actually begun to make it their own. And Museveni, I think from Uganda, is one of the real high points. Jerry Rawlings in Ghana is another. Nelson Mandela in South Africa, of course, is yet another of these new leaders that are emerging. And what are they beginning to say? First of all, I think they're assuming responsibility. In the olden days, after independence until maybe the mid to late 80s, they were always looking for scapegoats for why the economy was not working. So it was always, well, it's because of colonialism. It's because of imperialism. It's because of this history of European oppression that we are not as developed as we should be. Then, you know, later on, it was because of the world economy, it's because of the World Bank and the IMF, it's because we are debt-ridden, and many of these countries are. And oftentimes, debt repayment assumes like maybe 30 to 40% of the revenues of the government. So, you know, they get a loan from, say, the World Bank, and then they are supposed to use that for developing whatever, but then repayment comes maybe 2 or 3 years down the line, and they find that the thing that they had built, say the import substitution factory that they had built, is not generating the revenue that they thought they would get to repay the loan. And so they're having to take money from other spots, from healthcare, from education, from other areas, to pay the West for the loan that was given to them. And so oftentimes it was, you know, it's because of those loans, it's because of them that we are not developing. I think this new generation is saying, yeah, but we should have sort of realized that. We should assume that debt forgiveness is not in the cards. So let's either not take out debts or let's repay them and not say that that's their fault. One example. In the new country of Eritrea, just north of Ethiopia, it's located. New country just formed in 1993. Isaias Afwerki is one of these new generations of people, of leaders. He's very critical of other African leaders. He's very critical of the World Bank and IMF. He's also critical of NGOs, that's non-governmental organizations like Oxfam, like CARE, like Save the Children, like all of these development agencies. Why? Because he thinks they assume some kind of dependency. And he wants to develop Eritrea alone. So, you know, there's been many countries, many agencies that have come and said, we're willing to dump, you know, $10 million into your country. And he's oftentimes said, no, I don't want it. We're willing, you know, we've been fighting out in the bush for 20-odd years. We can do without. What we want to do is begin to form our own country from the. We want to have sort of a capitalist revolution right from within, and so it's this a willingness to assume responsibility, I think, that sets them apart. Secondly, Museveni really epitomizes this idea of willing to oppose the OAU, and. You know, let me draw a few countries here.
You have Eritrea here, you have Ethiopia sort of like that. Well, Eritrea is not quite that thin, sort of like that. You have Somalia, Kenya goes down here, you have Uganda over here, Tanzania, sort of like that. That'll be enough. Rwanda and Burundi here, and Zaire, sort of like, well, Zaire, sort of like that. Uganda is right in the middle of all sorts of unstable countries, Sudan being a big one over here. And according to the charter of the OAU, he's not supposed to interfere in any of these things. Well, he said, to heck with the OAU. What my country, the stability of my country, is dependent on the stability of other countries right around me. So if there's a dictator I don't like, if there's something going on that affects my country, I'm going to step in and support somebody who can change that. I'm going to support another rebel leader. He's interfering. Also, various governments, the Melda Zenawi in Ethiopia, is saying, well, you know, the OAU said you couldn't interfere with borders. Well, he just allowed Eritrea to secede from Ethiopia. That's creation of a whole new border. Various other parts in Africa, they've been tampering with borders to make it more in line with what should be more realistic borders. So they're just assuming responsibility for the internal security in Africa. Nigeria here, this is the best example, I saved it to last. In the Lutheran world, the Lutherans have, ELCA has some huge hospitals in Liberia over here. And we used to have quite a large Lutheran church in Liberia that grew out of the missionary effort. Liberia was a country that was formed by American slaves going back to Africa, and they were repatriated to this place called Liberia. If you look at the Liberian flag, it almost looks like an American one, except there's only one star. And that has just blown up into total civil war, into total chaos. People are being killed. Those Lutheran hospitals are all shut down. The doctors have fled. Nurses are... We have two Lutheran nurses, women who are, I think, in their late 50s and early 60s. And the stories that they tell of the chaos and the things that they have endured are just beyond conception. You know, being kidnapped and then released 3 days later after having not been fed, being force marched through the force of Liberia for maybe 200 miles, not knowing where they're going, all of these kinds of abuses. So it's a real chaotic area. Well, Nigeria and a few other countries in West Africa have sent military forces over there to stabilize the situation in Nigeria, in Liberia. And it looks like they sort of have. It's rather tenuous, but they're doing it internally. And I think this is sort of bodes well. Furthermore, this new generation of African leaders has adopted capitalism in sort of Maoist terms. You know, Mao Zedong from China, they would probably be characterized as capitalist roaders. And they've been willing to work with the IMF, willing to work with the World Bank. In Ethiopia, I'm always referring to Ethiopia simply because I've been there so much. In Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi's government has worked with the World Bank so much that for the last two major loans to Ethiopia, you know, the World Bank typically sends in their economists and all there, and they go, flitting through all of this material, and they come up with these big old schedules of repayment and all that. The Ethiopian government and their finance ministry sort of watched them, walked hand in hand with the World Bank officials through a couple of loans,
saw how they did it, and since then have done it for them, and totally opened up their books to the point where when I was there last summer, I was talking with someone from the World Bank, and he says, this is totally new. We've never experienced this in any other country that we have dealt with. There's always been a tendency to hide things from these foreign officials, these World Bank people who could, you know, take money, siphon money out of your country. But they've been so transparent in their finances that it has become a model of how the World Bank would like to work with other nations in the third world. So I think there's a real sort of realistic idea of how international finance works anywhere. The results are mixed though. What is happening is with any capitalist country, you are getting the entrepreneurs and the capitalists and the merchants and all that who are doing darn well. And you are getting some inflation, you are getting growing sort of taxation schedules, and all of a sudden sort of income disparity seems to be rising. And the people on fixed salaries, government salaried workers, teachers, whatnot, you know, the underclass are feeling the effects dramatically. And so even though it looks good per capita, even though per capita income is going up in many of the African countries, the bulk of the people are really starting to feel the pinch. But that's capitalism, isn't it? And that's what Milton Friedman would say is justified, because sooner or later they're going to go up too. And, you know, if one, I suppose one can have faith that that will happen, but, you know, there is a cost that is involved, very much so. How are these mixed results making their way into education and other areas? Education, this new generation of leaders feels the necessity for education. And they are putting more effort, at least lip service and everything, into education. They are inviting missions back into countries, especially if they will build schools, NGOs into countries, especially if they will build schools, or technical places, computer training centers, and this, that, and the other. Because they really feel that there's been enough of a brain drain of educated Africans to the United States, to Europe, that now they have to stop it. And the trouble is, if you train people up to college education, then they're much more likely to be invited or to want to go to Europe. And so what they're doing is saying, we've made that mistake before, so what we're going to invest in is primary education and secondary education up to high school. As you all know, a high schooler here in the United States can hardly get a job. You know, flipping burgers and that's about it. You almost need a college degree as a credential to do anything here in the United States. And so they're saying, well, if we are to prevent the brain drain to the West, we've got to stop. And so their effort is at low place. Well, what are they doing in terms of healthcare and the AIDS pandemic?
Isn't it also true that in the old education systems, they were more in an academic rather than anything that was practical?
Yes.
And so they weren't really any use to their countries anyway.
Yeah, it's the old vocational school fallacy argument. You know, everybody thought that the best way to go would be towards vocational schools, but the Africans didn't really want that. They wanted a very sort of strict, regimented, elite literary education. Why? Because that was the screening vehicle that would allow people to move to England, to France, to the United States. And so now they've realized that, and so they're
they're emphasizing vocational schooling much, much more. I'll try to quickly wrap up. Education has, you know, as I've talked about, healthcare has suffered, I think. And that's primarily because of the lack of doctors, because of the lack of medicines, and the AIDS pandemic that has sprung up in Africa. It's huge. It's 95% of AIDS deaths in the world are in Africa. Uganda, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and now it's just spreading to all sorts of countries that didn't even have them 10, 15 years ago. It's very, very frightening. So that's a source of enormous concern. There seems to be more regional cooperation between these countries. Remember, I was talking about all those railroads. Well, now they are making railroads between countries, a few. But more importantly, they're making road systems between countries, and they're trying to allow aircraft to go between countries. They're reducing the red tape for inter-regional trade. The downside of this new leadership, though, is that they're not really Democrats at all. They're just more of a realistic group of leaders who sees the insurmountable problems of Africa and want to solve them, are not corrupt, but are not really, really willing to let the reins go. And so when there is opposition, they are willing and able to use their military wings or their secret police or whatever to squelch opposition. And human rights abuses are still very, very prevalent in most of these countries, including Uganda, including Eritrea, and from what I've been reading even lately in South Africa under Nelson Mandela. I think that I'll stop there. I know we have a few minutes for questions, and I'll entertain you.
Just a way of background, what portion of Africa is developed? Is it becoming more so? Or
what portion of Africa is developed? In other words,
are there areas that are pretty much just isolated and on their own that the government doesn't have a lot to do with, or do governments really touch the lives of everyone?
I think by now governments have pretty much touched the lives of everyone. And just an illustration. In Ethiopia, before the famine of 1984-85, something like around 79 to 80% of the country the citizens of Ethiopia lived more than 5 kilometers away from the nearest road. Now, at least in Valparaiso, Indiana, I have a road that goes right into my house. My driveway goes right into my house, right into my garage, which I guess is part of my house. Now, can you imagine 80% of the population living from here to almost Heart Lake away from the nearest road? You know, we go up there, we truck up there and do our hikes up there, but that's what they have to do all the time to get anywhere. So we're feeling isolated here, but we have a road right into Holden Village. Since the famine, we built all sorts of road to distribute grain to the people, and now less than about 35% of our 5 kilometers away from the nearest road. So the tentacles of government, the tentacles of the modern sort of sector, the capitalist sector of the economy, is seeping into almost every nook and cranny of Africa. Kathy's brother lives in Tanzania, and Kathy and I have gone and visited him, and we oftentimes usually try to go on a safari into, you know, the game parks and all that. And before, we used to try to find areas, just vast areas of savanna that were uninhabited where their animals were without any game parks. And increasingly, it's harder and harder to find those vast areas of nature because people are there, because roads are there, and everything. Any other questions? Yes?
Is there any... Can North Africa ever be part of the southern sub-Saharan area? I mean, is Islam too different from the religion of the South? Is Islam too different?
Yeah. Islamic,
well,
you know, you can almost write across, do a belt like that. All of this area is pretty much Islamic. But then Islam is down in here, it's all over. You know, there's pockets of Islam all over Africa now.
And is that going to be a dish, is that going to cause militancy going to be disunifying?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think there will always be a separation between North Africa and the rest of Africa, pretty much because the Sahara is there. And the Sahara is almost impossible to get across with any efficiency. So North Africa is always going to be connected to the Middle East and to Europe. And they're going to differentiate themselves from the rest of Africa. But sub-Saharan Africa, or what we call Black Africa, Islam is, and Christianity are not really contentious. They are in a few instances, but not always. They seem to have, in many areas, they seem to be cohabiting quite well. As the embassies are blown up. So I probably will, as soon as I read a couple newspaper articles, I'll probably revise that answer. Any more questions? Well, I do thank you very much for coming here.
Thank you.